Yes, I'm K2, Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll hear three other guys running this net tonight. You'll hear John, KC2WGB, who maintains the mailbag and also looks at Echo Link, so that if people have trouble signing it, he knows about it, and you can send him messages. We got Paul, WS2N, who gives us the space report. We find out what's the latest that the National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing. Along the way, we sometimes hear from Hal, K6DPZ, who has a lot of electronic experience, and he gives us the value of that wisdom. The main purpose of the TechNet is education. The guys who are curious about wireless equipment, radio equipment, how it works, how to make it work better, and what's really going on at the molecular level. They gather here once every week for the last 32 and a fraction years, and that's been going on. This is TechNet number 1,557 of the series. That began in September of 1982. Let me drop. So these guys come together, ask each other questions, give each other answers. No guarantees, but it's essentially peer-reviewed material, and that's, even though there's some errors from time to time, the errors usually get corrected because all of this gets recorded. You can listen to the last 7 years, approximately, of TechNet by going to that beautiful website set up by Mike Number One. Mike Number One is Mike Perry, KC2NJI. His website is amateurradio.tangovictor. I got it right. I think it's amateurradio.tangovictor. Go there and you choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and each of these one-hour reels of what took place on the TechNet can be downloaded and listened to. And some people who are unable to stay up for the whole 4 hours of this TechNet, which lasts until midnight, they wait a few days into the next week where the recording appears on that website, and then they download it and listen to it during their noon hours or while they're commuting. There's another very useful website by Mike Number Two, which is at the website of limarktechnet.com. And at that website, you'll find other useful pieces of information that are coupled to the TechNet. Pictures of some of my antennas and me on my tower, and articles that support the TechNet, diagrams and articles and things like that. The TechNet has a very loose schedule that we sometimes violate the living daylights out of, where during the first hour we take general questions and try to give quasi-brief answers. That's followed by John choosing two, three, or four of the mailbag submittal. In other words, people who have sent him letters or emails with questions, and then communicating to him by way of the mailbag, so to speak, because they don't yet have the right equipment to talk to us directly, or don't yet have their ham radio license. These are some of the reasons why they communicate with John. He chooses some of the questions that he thinks are of general interest, and we discuss those. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, giving us the latest report on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. And at this time left over, we sometimes get into deeper subjects. So that's a loose schedule. We sometimes violate the daylights out of it. If we run into a real good hot subject, like to some degree, many a ham radio operator who is not afraid of a microphone really wishes that he worked in broadcast. So when Eric starts getting into Eric KE2EJ, our local broadcast engineer from Channel 13 and Channel 21, the PBS local stations in New York City and on Long Island, when he starts telling us what broadcast is really like and what the engineering of broadcast is really like, people get very excited about that subject, and it sometimes goes on for a considerable length of time. We get some very positive feedback from those discussions. People want to really know about broadcast. Oh, John?
Dick, by the way, I have a website for that information when you get a chance.
Okay. Now, we've already got Vito, W2BJF, and Joe, W2RYY, signed in from previous weeks. There was one other person last week, I can't remember his call letters, John, maybe you'll remember, that we promised that he would be number one on the runway this week. Maybe it was Tim, KD2AVU, I'm not quite sure. But whoever it was, we'll try to handle his question this week that didn't get handled last week. Now, John, you had a piece of information you wanted to give, so go ahead. KD2WGB, K2RAW in the tech land.
Radio Tim.
KD2WGB, Tim recognized. Yes, Dick. WA2SVM sent me a website, an address, a URL, and it's for information on WTC, the World Trade Center testing that's being done on Channel 12 and 32. If you want, I can give that listing. We can post it now, and maybe people will find that valuable.
I guess now's as good a time as any. Go right ahead, John.
Okay, very good. It's www.TVNewsCheck, H-E-C-K, TVNewsCheck.com /article/ A2062, and that'll take you to that information, and I'll give it more repeat. That's www.tvnewscheck.com/article/82062. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Okay, John. And, you apparently have gone to that website. Also, there was some testing that took place, I think, from the Empire State, no, from the New World Trade Center, the Freedom Tower. I think it took place last week. I wonder if you heard any reports of people listening to those broadcasts. I think Joe was telling us something about that. But what have you heard so far, John? Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Dick, I haven't heard anything new that we haven't discussed, but Joe Mayhead, I know he's really into this, so I had mentioned that website to him. He may have been there already, but he told me it would be a good idea to list it now tonight. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Very fine. Tim, were you signing in just now? And if so, give me your call letters, Tim. Go ahead.
KRW in the TechNet, KD2 Alpha Victor Uniform. Name is Tim. And yes, I signed in last week, and you said you're gonna put me on the runway for this week. So here I am. Back to you, Dick. K2RW, KD2AVU.
Okay, you're number one on the runway. I assume you've already done the engine RPM drop. Mag drop, as it's called. You've done your engine run up, and the engine's warmed up and ready to go. Some fun review. Some of those things took place a zillion years ago when I soloed in a J3 airplane. Okay, time for us to take the people who check in with questions or comments. We've already got Tim, Vito, and Joe. Anyone else who's going to be giving us a question or a comment this week? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RAW listening.
W2SAW Phil, yes.
To M. Paul with the Space Report. Good evening, Dick, John, everybody else.
Okay, we got Bill and we got Paul. And one more call. Anyone else to sign in because they do have a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RAW listening. Okay, we've got more than enough to get started. Tim, KD2AVU from last week, go right ahead with your question or comment. You got it, Tim. And go ahead, rev your engine.
K2RW in the TechNet, and good evening, everybody, and good evening, Dick. Last week, I mentioned something about my homebrew antenna tuner. It's a Z-Mesh, and what I've been experimenting with the antenna tuner was I figured out a way to measure the current on the output on the balanced line. So that's the subject. Back to you, Dick.
I'd like to hear how you did that. I know of people who have done experiments where they were able to, in a reasonably non-invasive manner, measure the current on various places along the length of a dipole, measure the current on one of the two leads of a twin lead or open wire feed line. And let's see how you did it, Tim. So go ahead and give us the description. KD2AVU, K2LAW, and the TechNet.
Dick, K2LAW in the TechNet, KD2AVU, returning. In this antenna tuner, I have the directional coupler, Stockton type coupler built into it, and I use that coupler to sense the SWR. So, clip it down to the output. You know, two outputs, balanced line, just let the ferrite core inductor go through the balanced line, you know, one on each side, and, you know, works pretty much like a clamp-on amp meter, you know, that type of thing. So, and then what I did was I used certain lengths of the open wire, and I put a load onto the end and run very low powers through the line. I did several testing with non-inductive resistors. Let me drop. I put a you know different loads to the end of the balanced line, and I used a probe I made. It's actually Fox Tango 50-61 type of ferrite ring, and I wound like I think it's 12 turns of magnet wire. I think it's a 22 gauge magnet wire onto the ring, and when I apply power to the balanced line on different frequencies, and I measure each side the current. So that's basically what I did. Back to you, Dick.
Now, what's not clear, but I'm going to make some guesses, is that you've got an antenna tuner. Quite possibly the antenna tuner did not, on itself, contain a output directional coupler. It sounds like you fabricated your own directional coupler on the balanced output. You talked about a particular ferrite bead that I guess either one or both of the balanced lines, the wire went through that ferrite bead. You told us you had 12 turns of number 22 gauge wire on that toroid. You didn't tell us if that was the primary or the secondary. I'm going to guess that that was the secondary. So in other words, one of the ways of measuring current on a line without the ferrite bead creating a very large voltage drop is to have the wire go through the center of the toroid just once. Multiple turns of current, multiple turns is the secondary winding where you're going to sense the current flowing through. And if you put a low enough value load resistor, in your case across the 12 turns, it represents a near short circuit on the one wire, one turn, or the one wire that goes straight through. Therefore, you get very little voltage drop, but still the amount of voltage drop you get across the terminating resistor on the 22 turns in your case, how many millivolts or volts you get across it, tells you roughly how much current is flowing. That's one way of doing it. And you told us you put various loads on the open wire balance lead output. If, for instance, it was a 600 ohm open wire output, and you put a 600 ohm resistor, assuming the resistor had low enough inductance, that represents a very good dummy load where very little current would be, very little power would be reflected. Then by putting other load resistors, like 300 ohms would make a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on a 600 ohm line, and so on. So by putting other load resistors, you could then calibrate the system. So I made a number of guesses from the partial information you gave me. Let's see how close I came with any of those, Tim. KD2AVU, KQLIW in the TechNet.
KQLIW, KD2AVU returning. You're very close. Actually, the 12 turns is the secondary, and the primary is just the conductor, you know, one conductor of the balanced line. So I put two toroid beads on the balanced line, one on each side, and I do not use a resistor short out the the leads that are coming out of the secondary winding. I just connect the secondary winding direct to a multimeter. And I do use different non-inductive resistors at the balanced line end to simulate the feed point impedance, say like 10 ohms all the way to 1200 ohms, and the reading I got, I think it's in the microamp region, so I only apply like 5 watts from my QRP rig. Back to you, Dick.
Now, you measured the output on a digital voltmeter, as I think you said, on the 12 turns. Most digital voltmeters in the AC scale are good up to probably 10 hertz in the AC mode, up to 10 kilohertz, 100 kilohertz, in that order. Very few digital voltmeters on the AC scale have any reasonable amount of calibrated sensitivity at, say, 3.5 megacycles to 30 megahertz. So what kind of a meter did you use there? Go ahead.
It's just a regular VG, I think, if I pronounce the name right, VG multimeter. I don't know, on certain frequencies it's the reading is very, let's say, unbalanced, like 30 meters I believe on 17 meters, but on the rest of the bands, it's very close, within like 2% to 5% deviation. I might do something, wrong there, but it's just experimenting. Back to you, Dick.
You told me that the digital voltmeter is a VG meter. Is VG a brand name? In the AC scale, what frequency is it rated to, if it is? And most digital voltmeters have test leads that are probably a foot and a half or 2 feet long, maybe 3 feet long, and wiring that long at, say, 3.5 megacycles to 30 megahertz would be highly inductive. The voltage you put in at one end and what you get out of the other end of those test leads would deviate a whole lot. So there's a bit of a problem there of trying to make quantitative measurements with a typical AC scale of a typical digital voltmeter. Now, somebody may make a digital voltmeter where the AC scale is rated to, let me say, 30 megahertz, but in which case the probe coming out of that digital voltmeter would be a very specific RF appropriate. In other words, it would either be a coaxial cable with some kind of small clip leads on the end of that coaxial cable, or it would be a shielded twin lead of a known impedance. So to make quantitative measurements on a AC scale of, say, a digital voltmeter represents a bit of a problem. There are ways of doing this better by putting a known load resistor across those 12 turns on your toroid and then putting a Schottky diode rectifier there with a small bypass capacitor, and then measure the and then measure the DC voltage you get off that rectifier circuit with proper calibration, that would definitely work at the HF frequencies you're probably interested in. But to directly measure the AC voltage on a digital voltmeter, I think is going to be fairly troublesome. To look for whether or not the voltage on the left side and the right side of the output 600 ohm line, to see if they're equal, yes, you can do that. But to make quantitative measurements of the length of usual test leads into a digital voltmeter, which is only rated for audio frequencies and not for RF frequencies, you can see how you can build up some pretty big errors there, in my opinion. So maybe your VG meter is rated for these frequencies. Over to you, Tim. KQRIW.
KQRIW, KD2AV return. Yes, I need to look up the specs of this. It's called VICHI, V-I-C-H-I. I think it's a Chinese made multimeter, but fairly accurate, I would say. But yes, thanks for the information on the another circuit. I think my SWR reading circuit in the tuner is pretty much the same. It's a Stockton type coupler and with a 1N34A diode and a 50 ohm load across the coupling circuit, so and it's pretty accurate, I would say. I used two LEDs for indicating the forward and reflected power, and I did calibration using a 50 ohm dummy load with a very short lead. I guess I'm going to try that next time. Back to you, Dick. K2IW, KD2AVU.
To put your two output leads of your balanced circuit, one wire at a time, where each wire goes straight through the center of a toroid ferrite core, and the toroid is, the ferrite is made for your particular frequencies, that's a good way of sensing the current. Multiple turns as a secondary winding builds up the voltage between that primary, essentially one turn, in your case, the 12 turns. The reason why people will put a load resistor across the 12 turns is that if the ferrite had a very high permeability and it was a fairly massive core, then the total amount of inductive increase, increase in inductance, that the open wire line going through the center of the core, that could experience a significant amount of inductance, giving you a significant voltage drop if you have a big enough ferrite toroid with a high enough permeability. Let me drop. By stepping up the voltage with the 12 turns, in your case, and putting a low enough load resistor so that now that represents a huge step up of voltage, that in turn means that the usual high inductance you would get from that one turn going through the toroid, giving you a significant voltage drop on your output twin lead, your output open wire, that could be lowered to a very small voltage by using a low enough load resistor on the 12 turns. It's really it's kind of a step-up transformer where you're almost shorting out the secondary winding. Therefore, the primary winding, the one wire going through, will act like a short circuit, and there'll be very little voltage drop. So there's a conflict of interest here. There's a compromise. As the load resistor gets smaller and smaller on the 12 turns, the voltage drop on the primary gets smaller and smaller, which is very desirable. But you don't want to be so small where you can't detect it. And now, detecting that voltage across the secondary winding and the 12 turns, if that was connected to a sensitive receiver and or spectrum analyzer, you could now make very well calibrated measurements and get a hell of a lot of sensitivity. The crystal diode recommended that I mentioned before, the Schottky diode or the 1N34 germanium diode. Let me drop it. When the voltage developed is, say, 1 volt or greater, then you can assume the diode has a consistent 2/10 of a voltage drop on the peak voltage, and the voltage you get out versus the RF voltage going in is very predictable. As the RF voltage on the 12 turns with its load resistor gets down to numbers like 2/10 of a volt RMS, now you're starting to look at the breakover voltage, the minimum voltage that the diode requires before it starts conducting. And so the calibration down there becomes a very nonlinear, square law-like, and so calibrating is a little bit more troublesome. Whereas if you were looking at that voltage up to 12 turns with the load resistor directly on a spectrum analyzer or a second receiver, now you've got tremendous sensitivity. A second receiver has 120 dB of gain. You can tune it to the right frequency. The signal strength meter can be calibrated, and now you can make very calibrated measurements. You would be able to confirm with your two toroids on your two 12-turn windings whether or not the left side and the right side is being equally loaded, equally fed. Measuring standing wave ratio on the twin lead output, the open wire output, let me drop it. To measure standing wave voltage there is a little bit more difficult, but let me think about that. There are ways of hooking up each of those toroids so that they become a directional coupler. Right now you've got a current sampling system. There are ways of making each one of those toroids a directional coupler. And by way of one of the articles for a standing wave ratio bridge that's in either the Radio Amateur's Handbook or the AR Oil Antenna book, there are ways that you can make each of those a directional coupler that will sense the forward going voltage going toward the antenna and whether or not there's any reflected voltage coming back from the antenna. There are ways of adding a little bit more circuitry to those toroids to make them into a directional coupler. And so that would be another very interesting experiment. Over to you, Tim. And so what you're going through right now is a very educational process, in my opinion. KD2-AVU, K2-RIW in the TechNet.
K2-RIW in the TechNet, KD2-AVU returning. Thank you, Dick. I will definitely look into that. And thanks for all the information. So I'll just keep on experimenting. And the match tuner, it's pretty interesting to me. It's just a multi-tank circuit. So, the reason to build that is, because it's a 1950s design and not many commercial source available, and maybe after I experimenting more with the balanced output measurement, I'll go ahead and measure the efficiency of this tuner. More questions coming, I'm pretty sure. And by the way, I saw a picture of you with W3IP on Facebook. Pretty interesting. It's posted in 205 a morning report group on Facebook. So, okay, back to you, Dick. That'll be all my questions here. K2RW in TechNet, KD2AVU.
When it comes to your antenna tuner and you're worried about its efficiency, the quickest way to measure its efficiency is to measure the only way it can become inefficient, assuming the circuit is reasonably well shielded and it itself cannot radiate. It's in a pretty well closed box. You know that it's not radiating the power. If there is assuming you've got a coaxial cable going from the transmitter going into it, and you've got a directional power sensing circuit there, like a Bird wattmeter or a Viswa sensing circuit, antenna tuner, antenna analyzer. If you've got some kind of instrumentation between the transmitter and the tuner, when the tuner is properly adjusted for the load that's presented to it, you'll have a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, no reflected power. Therefore, all the power coming out of the transmitter, you're always going into the tuner, none of it's coming back. You would like to believe that all the power coming out of the tuner is going into the open wire line. Any amount of power that doesn't go into the open wire line and isn't reflected back to the transmitter, the only way it could waste it is by turning it into heat. Therefore, run the tuner at some convenient amount of power, key down, for some number of minutes. Let me drop it. Like if it's connected to a real good antenna that you know can tolerate 100 watts, we'll run the transmitter key down at the 100 watt level for 3 minutes. Then turn it off, turn off the transmitter, and open up the cover of the box real fast, reach in there, and touch everything with your fingers. If everything is ice cold, it is not wasting any power. Depending how hot the coil is or the capacitor is and so on, is giving you a very strong indication of whether or not it's wasting any power. The only mechanism it can waste power is by turning it into heat or radiating it because of lack of shielding or reflecting it back to the transmitter. And you can confirm every one of those. So the most sensitive test for efficiency of a circuit is thermal. The sophisticated way of doing it would be to look at the circuit with a thermal imaging camera to see if anything's getting hot. And if everything's ice cold, then you've got it made. And the reason why this is such a sensitive test, let me give you an example. Lots and lots of guys on 20 meters, day in and day out, heard them saying that each UHF connector, an SO239 and a PL259, creates half a dB of insertion loss. Lots of people believe that, particularly at frequencies like 2 meters and 432. And lots of guys were taking things like a Mirage amplifier that has UHF connectors going in and out, and they would go through the process of replacing those UHF connectors with type N connectors, the UG58, for instance, the female chassis mount type N connector. And they thought they picked up half a dB of improvement in signal flow on each one of those connectors. They really believed that. And I said to myself, this is crazy. What I did is to take my 432 megacycle strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier, which can put out 700 watts. And I took 700 watts output from that amplifier through a pair of connectors, a PL259 and an SO239 bolus. So a pair of connectors, I poured 700 watts through it for something like 5 solid minutes into my antenna on top of the tower. And after the end, at the end of those 5 minutes of 700 watts, those two connectors became slightly warm to the touch. And if I estimated that slightly warm was 1 watt, 1 watt of dissipation out of 700 watts is something like 0.02 dB of insertion loss, something extremely small. As you can tell, measuring very small amounts of loss by the thermal process with ham radio equipment is an extremely sensitive test. Let me drop it. By using any kind of ordinary laboratory instrumentation, you try to confirm the insertion loss of 0.02 dB, and you would have error in your measurements that can easily be 10 times higher than the measurement you're trying to make. Let me give you an example of that. The SO239 PL259 combination. You study the center conductor diameter and the outer conductor diameter, and you find out it has a characteristic impedance of 35 ohms, not 50 ohms. But because that combination is only an inch or two long, which is 1/27th of a wavelength at 432, it's an extremely minor perturbation. However, 35 ohm line, a 20th of a wavelength long, so to speak, in between 50 ohm instrumentation that has a little bit of VISWR, and a 50-ohm detector equipment that has a little bit of VISWR, and now you're adding and subtracting that bullet-barrel combination. Just the insertion loss of a 35-ohm piece of line in a 50-ohm system of improper, non-perfect VISWR on the source of signal and the load of signal can give you errors of 0.2 dB real easily in the apparent measurement when you're trying to measure 0.02 dB of insertion loss. You can see how the trombone effect of adding that chunk of stuff and you're doing a substitution test. On paper, it looks beautiful. You do it in the real world, you'll end up with errors bigger than the insertion loss you're trying to measure. Let me drop. But it's not standing wave ratio reflections you're trying to measure. You're trying to measure real insertion loss of dissipation of power. And the only way you can dissipate power is to create heat. And that the heat it creates is 1 watt worth of heat. When 700 watts is flowing through it for 5 or 10 solid minutes, you've done an extremely good confirmation by the laws of conservation of energy, a confirmation of the real insertion loss. So you can see how that's an extremely powerful test. By that token, you try to measure the insertion loss or the lack of 100% efficiency of your antenna tuner. If you do it thermally, you'll have a hell of a lot more sensitive and a hell of a lot more accurate measurement than any other technique, in my opinion. Back to you for any comments on this one, Tim. KD2AVU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2RIW, KD2AVU returning. Yes, I actually did the thermal test. I had a 100-watt key down for a minute or so, I think. But the end result was I mounted my antenna. It's a wire vertical dipole, and it was feed by open wire. But at some point, I didn't notice that until later. At some point, the wire was twisted together, so it couldn't stand the current or voltage at that point, so it shorted out at the feed point, I think. Yeah. So I actually did that, and I touched the toroid core. It's a 2-inch toroid core in the tuner, and it's actually quite cold. You know, I do not notice any temperature on that, but I will confirm it with my multimeter again. It has a thermal meter on it too, so next time I'll just put the probe onto the toroid and see what's the temperature rise on the toroid after like a 1 minute or 2 minute 100 watt key down on the antenna tuner. So back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KD2AVU.
For those people who get QST Magazine, the June issue, 2015, on page 34, it's got a 5-page article of various combinations of coax and open wire leads feeding an antenna with various kinds of tuners. And in that particular article, very well done article, they estimated the insertion loss of the tuner by making estimations of the equivalent series resistance of the coil and the equivalent series resistance of the variable capacitor of a Pi network antenna tuner, for instance. They made estimates as to what the insertion loss should be. And I'm a little bit disappointed by that because, in my opinion, the estimations are pessimistic. In other words, they made estimations as to how much loss the components had, therefore how much loss the whole tuner should have, knowing how much calculated current is flowing through each of those components by way of a computer program. Had they really done the test by putting, say, 100 watts through it for 5 or 10 minutes and measuring the amount of heat of the coil and heat of the capacitor, I think the measurements would have been a lot more accurate, a lot more traceable to the bureau, because each of their insertion losses of the antenna tuner, in my opinion, the numbers look to me too high, the dBs of loss of the tuner. I'm having trouble believing it. So I wish they had done it thermally. A little bit disappointed they didn't think about it that way. One other thing I want to bring to your attention, let me drop it. And that is one of the things that's a little bit hard to believe, but the way it's quite often done professionally. When you want to measure the current flowing through a piece of wire, and assuming that piece of wire has a reasonable spacing to other things. In the case of 600 ohm or 450 ohm open wire line, the spacing between those two wires is sufficiently large, or in the case of a dipole, the wire of the dipole is usually a large distance away from other objects like the ground and the gutter of the house and so on. When you've got a reasonable amount of spacing, recognizing the fact that any RF current flowing through that piece of wire produces an extremely well documentable, calibratable amount of local magnetic field. Therefore, if at the end of a piece of coaxial cable, semi-rigid coaxial cable, your RG58, or a miniature coaxial cable, you have an extremely small current loop. In other words, you take the center conductor of that coaxial cable, fold it back on itself and short it to the shield, and maybe that loop that I'm just describing has a half inch or a quarter inch of inside diameter, an extremely small current sensing loop. And you place that as close as you can get to the wire of interest. There are ways that you can calibrate that system as to how much voltage is induced into that so-called short-turned coil, that one-turn loop that I'm describing. The voltage that it picks up is going to be kind of small. You're going to want to pick it up with either a receiver or a spectrum analyzer, but that that allows you, with a calibration procedure, allows you to sense the amount of current flowing in that wire. And so you don't need a toroid, you don't need the 12 turns, you don't need all of this other elaborate circuitry. It can be done with a very small current sensing loop, and the amount of area that loop determines how much...
Repeater, timeout.
The area of that loop determines how many volts you pick up because of the local magnetic field in the wire of interest created by the current flowing through it. So those current sensing loops... a snip bit around the whole perimeter. I wonder if that makes some sense, Tim. So at some later time, you may want to do an experiment with a very simple sensing current loop like I'm describing, which is a hell of a lot less invasive than putting a toroid in there. Tuner itself, or you can establish that externally by putting a bird watt meter on that input lead. Over to you, Tim, K2RIW.
Dick, thanks for the information, and I'm going to try that, but I got to, maybe I can use the software-defined
Your software-defined radio, or as long as the system is reasonably well shielded, in other words, you want to make sure that any signal being coupled through the cabinet of the transmitter radiated to space is not being picked up through the cabinet of the receiver. As long as the transmission cable very well by way of the calibrated output dial and some real good signal generator. If this was the best of all worlds, by definition, a S9 signal strength signal is supposed to be 50 microvolts, and each S unit is half voltage. Each S unit is supposed to be 6 dB different. When you go from S9 to S8 on your single strength meter, that's supposed to be a 6 dB change, which is supposed to be a 2-to-1 voltage change. Therefore, 50 microvolts of S9 becomes 25 microvolts of S8 and 12.5 microvolts of S7, and so on. That's if it's calibrated. You do that test with a good signal generator on almost any receiver you can get a hold of, even a high-quality Collins receiver. You'll be very disappointed, and you'll find out that the signal strength meter, in most cases, it's kind of crazy. My Drake, S9 plus 10 and S9 plus 20 and 30 dB, those numbers were pretty far wrong. So it's easy to make a calibration scale, but you will discover that the most signal strength meters are pretty far wrong. And to get around that problem, you may know that I went to your company to buy a refrigerator recently because my refrigerator failed, and very happy with the results. To meet to BJF. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Very good indeed. I'm copying you fine. Okay about the refrigerator. Absolutely. Stand by 1 second.
And by the way, to inject, I went to the websites of a zillion different companies that can supply a refrigerator to me. The problem was that I chose a very specific refrigerator. I like efficiency star rating, I like the number of cubic feet, I like the layout, I like the way the shelves were arranged. Once I selected a particular 23 cubic foot refrigerator with two doors and a top side of the freezer, once I selected a particular brand name and model number, I went to each of the available sources, and each one of them said, we do not stock that machine. It's in our warehouse in Philadelphia. It'll take us 2 weeks to get it. It'll take us 10 days to get it. And when I went to your particular company, they said, we can supply that to you in 4 days. And I said, you've got a deal. and it went over there and signed all the paperwork, and it showed up in 3 days. What are you, Vito? Put me to BJF, K2RAW.
Which store did you go to, Dick? I'm the one in Bayshore.
I went to the one on Jericho Turnpike in Comac. And I'm trying to remember. Naomi was the lady who handled the sale with me, and it all worked out very well. Over to you, Vito.
Yes, the one across from Trader Joe's, I'm pretty sure. It's a blue box out of Heine's. I remember from last week with the, last several weeks with the Mosley tri-band beam and the issues I was having with that, with the 3-1, 4-1 SWR on that beam. Let me drop. Well, over the several months period of playing with the silly thing, I did tell you I had gotten two new driven elements, traps for the driven element, and replaced them, and it did not solve anything. The FWR was still 3-10 tuner. Now, the last thing was left was a piece of coax that went from the transit trap, lightning arrestor on the tower, up the tower about 18, 20 feet up, and it went to the termination point on the beam. Let me drop. I took that piece out. I contacted a friend who makes up the RG214 cable, and he put a nice quality connector on one end, left the other on, and unterminated. I terminated myself with spades, and a good quality thick spades, and I did a good job with the shrink tubing. Very well put together. So I could only be the problem. Doing all this, I jumped up to 6, possibly 7-1. I says, oh goodness, what can this be? So the first thing I was thinking was, let me drop. I realized at 3-1 that, if I may use the terminology, a pipeline to be used in college or to tech, the pipeline of the old piece of coax had an obstacle in its way. It was holding back some of the power, some of the water flow. The new, broke through, and it dropped down to perfect. Now my question is, let me drop. Unless I'm not correct in assuming this, is it possible these two new traps on the driven element had to be burned in? Maybe they burned in, I'm just using this language, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, I know I probably am wrong, and suddenly everything came to life and has been perfect ever since and no more issues. What do you think, Dick? Back to you.
I say that's very unlikely, Vito. You certainly have one hell of a mystery there. That trap really consists of a coil and a capacitor. Pretty sure the capacitor is across the coil, maybe not across the whole coil, maybe it's only a few of the turns of the coil. But a capacitor needing burning in, a coil needing burning in, I doubt that very highly. You've got a bit of a mystery. Now, the fact that the standing wave ratio on the new cable is higher, your water analogy is good. Whenever you've got a known amount of attenuation in a transmission system between the shack and the antenna, it could be a slightly lossy piece of coax, it could be a low loss piece of coax with a fixed attenuator at one end or the other. No matter what creates insertion loss of the transmission system, means that the signal that gets to the antenna is slightly weaker. If the antenna has any visoir, that really means that a certain percentage of the power that gets to the antenna is going to reflect back. The reflected power has to go back through the same piece of cable again, experience the exact same insertion loss on the second trip on the way down. Therefore, the reflected signal getting down to the shack becomes weaker. Therefore, the apparent standing wave ratio will be lower when you have lossy cable. When you put in a lower loss piece of cable or take out the attenuator, whatever the true standing wave ratio of the antenna is, you will see more of it in the shack, and the real measured visoir will get higher. So your replacement of the cable and higher visoir, at first it's shocking, you think something's wrong, it really could be good news as far as the transmission system is concerned. Let me drop. and your higher 6-to-1 standing wave ratio could very well be closer to the real standing wave ratio. For all we know, your real standing wave ratio of the antenna when it was in the failed mode was 8-to-1. For your new piece of cable, you saw an apparent 6-to-1. For your old lossier piece of cable, you saw a 3 or 4-to-1. So that all hangs together. Now, how can the antenna suddenly go from an extremely high standing wave ratio, 6-to-1 or 7-to-1 maybe was the real number, and suddenly jump down to 1-to-1, almost no reflected power? That suggests some kind of an intermittent contact somewhere. In the worst case, it could be the whisker of a the outer braid of this coax cable bridging the conductor, bridging the gap between center conductor and the outer shield, and it suddenly decided to break contact or got burned away with RF power. I mean, when any normal object like water boiling away or whatever, let me drop it. Most normal changes of standing wave ratio are gradual. To suddenly go from something very high to something very low, that has to be the equivalent of an opening and breaking, opening and closing contact, if you know what I mean. A contact somewhere had a lot of oxide on it, and it suddenly burned through and made contact. Not likely in your case, because you cleaned everything up. A short circuit that suddenly became an open circuit, that's more likely. But the traps being burned in, I doubt it highly. On top of that, you and I already discussed whether or not any of the other traps on the director or reflector, could they be causing it? And the answer is almost no, because my experience tells me that on a usual Yagi, when the driven element is properly fed and working correctly, if you set the reflector one at a time, you can make a 1-to-1 Vizwar go to 3-to-1, but a 6-to-1, I doubt it. I don't think a mistuning of a director can make the driven element's standing wave ratio go that high. So right now, I'm not suspicious of your other traps. You've got a bit of a mystery. Let's hope it stays in the good working mode. And so, right now, you've got a mystery about a conundrum wrapped up in an anomaly. You've got a tough case there, Vito. Intermittents are always very tough. As time goes on, though, you'll eventually find out what's going on, I think. W2PJF, K2RIW. Go ahead with your other subject if you want to. You got a Vito.
W2YY with a question on this subject.
You got it, Joe.
Yeah, my question is directly to Vito. Is the antenna, I was basically listening to your problem there. Does the antenna you're feeding, is that a some sort of DC grounded antenna, or is both halves the dipole elements, or the elements you're feeding, completely separated above ground? Back to you.
You've got it, Dino.
Okay, I'm not really sure how to answer that question. Let me tell you what the antenna is. It's a Moseley Tri-Band TA-33 Senior Beam. It's about 17 years of age. And that's the type of antenna. It has 6 traps on it. Back to you.
Okay, well, what Dick says makes a lot of sense. You may have a short or possibly some sort of open connection on one of your connections to the either part of your dipole. But a simple thing to do from the shack end, even if you're going through one of these lightning arresters or whatever you're going through, they should show infinity across the line. And if you're feeding an antenna that has 2 dipole elements, whether you have traps in the antennas and in the elements or not, across them you should show infinity. So a very simple check would be take a digital VOM and go across your coax. You should see absolutely infinity. If you see anything less than that, you may have water, moisture, something like that, some content in your coax line, give you the grief.
He didn't say it, but he meant ohmmeter measurement. So did you ever have a chance to do an ohmmeter measurement on the coax cable back in the shack, Vito? Go ahead.
At the station, at this radio room section of the coax cable, I took it off the back of the antenna tuner, put an ohmmeter across, the center conductor to shield, and read open. So I said, okay, is that correct? I wasn't sure. So to the top of the tower, what I did was I put a pair of alligator clips across with a piece of wire from the one conductor to the other on the two set screws, came back to the station, looked at it with the ohmmeter, I saw it the short. When up there, took it away, it was open again. It was clear. And the antenna, with that reading, and still that same reading, had those two types of responses, you know, high SWR and then a perfect signal leaving. Then I said to myself, intermittent, the word you use yourself. So I rotated the beam, different north, south, east, west, back and forth, let the beam shake back and forth, you know, abruptly, just let go of the switch, hit it again, let the beam wiggle around on top of the roof, on top of the tower, and nothing came in. I said, maybe something will come in. So maybe it's what you said, Dick, maybe a little hairline, little thing, something between the shields and center conductor, something somewhere got burned away. By the way, I raised the power to 300 watts as well from only 100, and everything is still fine, Dick. So this is where I stand. Go ahead.
Joe, with your knowledge of the TA-33 senior 17 years ago, I am guessing that the left side and the right side of that driven element are insulated from the boom, held with some kind of a plastic-like structure. Is that your memory on that particular antenna, Joe? M-E-2-L-Y-Y, E-2-L-I-W?
Well, I don't know about that. I've never owned one of these antennas. I'm just asking this question in general because, you know, a simple check that I've learned from just, you know, working with antenna systems is to evaluate if you have a DC grounded type of antenna assembly, especially working with commercial ones. And if you do, you can't check the ohms across the cable because it'll read short to the antenna. But in a case where an HF antenna is being used, you should read infinity. You know, a simple thing to do also to see if you really have a problem is to put it on a frequency of a known station. Even though it's out of band, you can take it on 20 meters, go up to 15 megahertz, and try to receive WWV. If you don't hear it very well at all, or it's coming in very weak, you might have a bad connection, not from your coax to your first part of your element, but maybe since your elements are very old, they might have corrosion between the different aluminum pieces, causing a little bit of grief. But if it receives good, generally it should transmit good. Back to you.
You quite possibly have telescoping aluminum elements on this antenna, and so whether or not they're making extremely good contact when the aluminum oxide is being built up after 17 years, that's a possible factor. Some of the slightly compact beams, I'm saying slightly compact, whenever you put loading coils, traps, into an antenna, there's two reasons for doing it. Number one, to make it work on multiple frequencies, and number two, to shrink down the size a little bit. On many of those slightly decreased size trap type antennas, the center conductor, the center of the driven element, is fed with a hairpin-like structure along with the lug, so to speak. And so whether or not the individual telescoping elements are making a micro-ohms of contact and whether or not they burn through the aluminum oxide is a factor. And I am guessing in your case there probably is no hairpin, because if there was, you wouldn't have been able to measure infinity in the shack. You would have measured something closer to 0 ohms. Back to you, Vito. To B2PJF, K2RIW in the TechNet. So, I was hearing you on the input, Vito, not to worry. So I think you're saying that your ohm meter always measured the same. Infinity in the shack, unless you put that short circuit up at the antenna. Is that true, Vito? Go ahead.
Yes, that's correct. Also, to answer your question, looking at the beams and the ground up under, right under the top of the tower, the right side, the right element is a strap that ties that element to the actual assembly, the antenna assembly, together. It's all tied together with a ground strap. That's the shield side. The other side is not. It's insulated. In fact, they both have plastic inserts to the left away from the rest of the antenna itself. It's just the actual element itself, high and dry, leaving the center conductor.